Hey, everybody, welcome back. This is the first, it's going to be about the last year, but it's the first new visual effects show, VFX show of the new year. And I'm here with Ron Brinkman in LA.
Hey.
Hey, Ron. What are you doing now?
Oh, since we last spoke?
Yes.
Or since we last spoke as a podcast, at least?
Yeah.
I don't know how long ago was that?
It was pretty early. Months.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was still.
Feels like years. I'm so sad.
I'm back, or at least for today. I was still at Apple. Back then, right?
Right.
So I have left Apple. I've been doing consulting work for a couple different places. I finished writing the book.
You finished
dozen countries.
You finished writing the book.
I just pretty much turned in all of the last of the text within the last week or so.
So it's just is it the same title?
Yeah, it's still The Art and Science of Digital Compositing.
Of course, that's the official title, but inside the Pixel Corps, for the listeners here, inside the Pixel Corps, we like to call it The Good Book of Brinkman.
That'll work, too. I'll put it in as a subtitle.
Yeah, exactly. We're also here with Mike Seymour. Down under.
Hey, how are you, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. And let's just big holler shout out. The fact that David and Mark aren't here, don't read anything into that. We're going to have a mixed posse moving forward this year, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, one of the big things is to get the show more regular and make it a little less stressful for everyone. We're really trying to have lots of different people. So we'll have probably a general posse of about 6 to 8 people that we bring on. They'll only be anywhere from 2 to 4 of us on any one time, but we'll be kind of pulling from different people depending on the show and depending on availability of everyone. I mean, all of us are in production, you know, doing stuff. So we're not full-time journalists, and so sometimes our schedules get out of control. So
and you would think that it would be easy for everybody to just manage to find an hour to sit down and talk, but it proves to be surprisingly difficult.
Especially given the time zones. You know,
yeah,
talking about
everything.
Me coordinating with you guys when you're like, well, let's do that. I'm like, well, that'd be 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not so keen on that. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I certainly just kind of got too busy to deal with some of that for a while there. So,
yeah.
But hopefully, like I said, with the book being more or less turned over, I mean, there's still going to be another couple of months of back and forth with the publisher, but at least I have a little more time to do some stuff.
Sounds excellent. Now, today we're going to be looking at two things. One is we're going to be going and looking into the last year and seeing what happened and our opinions about that, and then we'll look into the next year, into 2008, and see what's coming up, because we've got, of course, a incredible collection of new movies that are going to be effects laden. So this last year, I mean, really the last year, the biggest films of the year were all effects films, I believe.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't think there was any breakout hits that weren't at some level massively effects driven.
And I think that one of the things that's interesting about that is that, you know, I have a personal opinion that as we look at the success of the movie industry, we're really you know, going down a path where you really have to have a movie that's visually arresting to make people go to the theater. When we all have big HD monitors at home and good sound systems and everything else, a lot of the kind of the character driven stuff, you know, is, I can watch that on TV. I can watch Sideways on TV, and we've talked about this before. But the stuff that is very visually interesting, now, it doesn't have to be effects, but it has to be cinematically very well done, are the things that I think are going to continue to excel over the next, you know, into the future, because that gives you that's one of the big reasons to go to see the movie. Do you guys agree?
I totally agree, and I think it's the only thing that's sort of going to keep the studio model, if you will, surviving with all this other pressure. I mean, I think that this is the first steps towards, you know, independent distributors and whoever being able to put out films, and they're not going to be able to afford to finance a 50, 80, $120 million movie. So, you know, for the little independents. So that's just going to be the studios, and I think that's all they're going to end up doing is concentrating on these big ticket items.
I think it's kind of interesting, though, for me personally, what I would love to see happen is a return to the Gandhis and Out of Africa, the kind of films that are sweeping and epic and need to be seen on a big screen. Don't necessarily need to be effects films. But I think what's going to happen is what's happened with, say, Alien versus Predator, you know, which is, what, the sixth Alien film and the fourth or third Predator film, which was made for like $40 million by a couple of guys that are brilliant and is going to make them a ton of money. And people are going to go to the cinema because it's engrossing and it's also going to go well on DVD and it's going to have effects, but it's not going to have $200 million because nobody wants to stick their neck out that far.
So here, by the way, I pulled this up on IMDb just to kind of give people an idea, and maybe we'll go through some of these movies and talk about some of these top movies here. But just to throw them out there, Spider number one in as far as gross in the U.S. and I guess I could go gross worldwide here and probably change it a bit. But let's see here. I can only do by year in the U.S. I think. Or maybe I can. By the way, if you don't have IMDb Pro and you're in the industry, you're really missing out. All right, so Spider-Man 3, number one, budget $258 million. Shrek the Third, number two, budget $160 million. Transformers, budget $150 million. Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, number four, and it is a budget of $300 million. Harry Potter, budget of $150 million. Bourne Ultimatum, which is arguably less visual effects, but still a ton of them. $110 million. 300, which was only $65 million. In the top 10, 300 is probably the lowest budget film there. And then number 8, Ratatouille, all CG, $150 million. I Am Legend, the budget's not publicized. I have no idea what it is, probably 100 million, 120 million, 150 million, something like that. Simpsons is only 75 million, a steal. But the Simpsons are all the. What are the Simpsons done in? India.
It was done as traditional animation. Yeah. Hey, you know what's something really interesting about that list that you did?
Yeah.
And I was trying to count it in my head. Stop me if I'm wrong here, but with the exception of Ratatouille, and maybe you could argue one of the two of the others, all of those were either books, video games, or theme park rides, or just sequels, right? They're like, there's almost nothing there that you, apart from Ratatouille, that you described as original screenplay.
Yeah, you don't get to that until you get to, and I don't know whether this was based on a book or not, but Wild Hogs is number 11, so that was a non-effects driven film. And I have to admit, did you guys see that film?
I can't believe it made that much money, though.
Who went to see that film? I was just like, I haven't gone to see it, and I just can't even bring myself
to. Now, hang on, does that include aeroplane audiences around the world in transit?
Yeah, no, yeah, I know. Maybe. Yeah, exactly. And then you had, like, Knocked Up, which was number 12. And then, you know, it starts to get more, which I didn't, you know, I watched it. I wasn't that impressed. But one of the things that it seems like, I mean, Ratatouille, yeah, you're right, Ratatouille, Shrek, you know, I guess is a sequel. You know, it's not really original. I mean, it's not an original idea. So, was 300 really a...
Well, it was based on other things as well. So, you know, 300 is based on a comic book. Simpsons is based on a TV series. Obviously, a lot of those are sequels.
Of course, one would argue that everything's based on something. I mean, you know.
No, that's true. But it's like, I think it's increasingly important to get, and that's my point about the Aliens Predator thing, it's increasingly important to get some kind of brand recognition on the name to get the film greenlit. You see, so you go to somebody and say, and called, you know, The Desk, and they say, well, it's never going to work. And then you say, well, I've got this film that's based on a TV show, based on a game, based on a whatever. And they go,
because they have, I mean, I know people that do this, and, you know, they have the people that have pitched all this, and everybody sits down and they put together their spreadsheets that, of course, spin the numbers in the way they want to, but, you know, they say, well, for this type of movie or for something based on properties like this or based on, you know, it's total accounting kind of stuff that drives whether or not something gets greenlit.
But in that vein, wouldn't 300 and, as I say, like an Alien versus Predator Requiem be ideal? Because it's heavily effects driven, so you've got some control in post in the sense you can see what's going on and you can change it with test audience driven. It's going to make a ton of money and it doesn't cost a ton of money to make.
Mm-hmm. I think that is probably seen as the sweet spot, but I think every studio also wants their big blockbuster kind of things. You know, I don't think Aliens vs. Predator is going to be considered a blockbuster kind of a movie the way 300 was.
Well, what's interesting is I think that actually when you look at the top 10 at least, I think that just from the U.S. gross, I think you're actually looking at the highest percentage return on the film was actually 300.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, you see, because like if you lay out for example, Spider-Man 3, like that is not a cheap film to make, right? And I'm not saying it's a bad film. I'm just saying it's not cheap, right? And if you want to double your money, you have to get spectacular grosses. And if you happen to have a flop, and not that Spider-Man 3 was, but if you happen to have a sequel that doesn't go very well and you've invested hundreds of millions, you got to be thinking that's someone's job, or at least several people's jobs.
Well, and a lot of it's figuring out, you know, what those, you know, because for instance, the, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean from the U.S., now they made a lot more money overseas, but from the U.S. return, you're talking about a budget of $300 million and a U.S. gross of $309 million for Pirates of the Caribbean. You know, so it's...
So double that for international and what, double it for DVD?
Right. So those are all, you know, they'll make $1 billion on, I mean, the calculation for Pirates was they'd make $1 billion on every film. I mean, that was, you know, they gross $1 billion for every film. I mean, that's how they derived.
And Disney has the ability to market a film like that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a film that they can kind of put together. And really, I mean, I think that if we start comparing some of this stuff, I still think that we're looking at another year where, you know, another Pirates film. And you know, it still, I think, is defining the, you know, what the state of the art of visual effects is. You know,
well,
I think between
well,
that and 300.
Let me swing around the other way then and say if that's what they were doing in terms of grosses, and if we can be so bold as to suggest the Oscars have some reflection on content, then this is the list of films that are going to be up for – this will be up for the bake-off. In other words, this isn't the films in the bake-off. These are the 15 that are going to go into the bake-off.
Yep.
Or at least 7 of these will be in the bake-off. Beowulf, Bourne Ultimatum, Evan Almighty, Golden Compass, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, I Am Legend – Live Free or Die Hard, which is another Die Hard sequel.
Do you think that really go into the bake-off?
Well, wait, there are worse. National Treasure, Book of Secrets, Pirates of the Caribbean, Ratatouille, Spider-Man 3, Sunshine, 300, Transformers, and The Water Horse. So those are the 15 that are being considered for the 7 that will go into the bake-off.
Oh, okay.
Right,
okay.
Yeah, so you get 7 out of those, and then the 3.
Yeah, and then 3 out of those, and then 1 wins.
Right.
But that's meant to be, that's the field upon which you're going to be harvesting from. So I guess the question is, do you want to pick, you know, which ones aren't going to make and which will definitely make that the bake-off or even the final three?
Yeah, and usually you can run down the list of money grossers and they'll certainly make the bake-off. You know, you will absolutely see Pirates and Spider-Man and Harry Potter and...
Except remember the year that The Matrix didn't get nominated? Did it get to the bake-off?
It got to the bake-off, though.
It got really snubbed.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I know it's not a perfect process, but, yeah.
If you were going to pick three, what would they be?
If you pick the three, I'm concerned. I'd be worried that, you know, what ends up being the three would be Transformers, Pirates, and Spider-Man. Those are sort of the three obvious ones just because they have that magic mix of lots of work that was all good work and made lots of money. I would hope that they'd go a little bit further afield for some of it, though.
Well, what's incredibly interesting is the inclusion of Beowulf and Ratatouille, because what they've done is they've included for consideration fully animated films, but this is in the visual effects category. So in other words, they're saying, oh, you could separately win an Academy Award for Best, you know, Animated Film, but we might also give you a Visual Effects Award for the visual effects separate to the character animation.
I think it's double dipping.
Yeah, do you guys think that's appropriate to put animated movies up as effects films?
You do?
No, I'm asking, do you?
I don't think so. I think if they're animated films, they're animated films.
I think it's really tough that if you work on a fully animated film, you're not going to win if you're in the effects department, because the effects department does great work. But I'd also say you're not going to win for best picture if you make a comedy. And that's just the kind of, you know, that's right. How the Oscars work. And I just think it would be bizarre if a film won for best. I mean, the work in Ratatouille for the food, right, just for example, the actual technical quality of the food rendering was just magnificent, right? But I think it'd be really harsh to give a visual effects Oscar to a fully animated feature.
And I don't know where do you draw the line for what you consider to be visual effects work even? I don't know. I mean, certainly the technologies obviously overlap dramatically, and you're doing much of the same things and requires the same skill sets and you use the same tools and everything like that. But I don't know where you draw a line. I mean, at some level, I think visual effects implies integration work. And if you've got control over every piece of it, I mean, you're still doing integration work. And anybody that's worked on an animated movie knows that you are doing tons of the same stuff, up to the level of, you know, even doing wire removals or object removal, maybe not wire removal. You're definitely doing artifact removal. I've done that on a bunch of shots in animated stuff.
I found that to be fascinating. I think we talked about this on another show that I was talking to someone from an animation company, and I asked him what he did, and he said, I do roto. And it was just this odd thing to think that there was a paint fix, and they said it's just cheaper to paint it out than re-render it. You know, and so that, yeah, there's plenty of that, but I don't know if it's I don't know if I really classify that as visual effects.
Well, okay, so if we sideline for a second Beowulf and Ratatouille, and if we also sideline the three big, you know, blockbuster Transformers, Pirates, and what's it, Spider-Man 3, you said, what of the others does anyone, I mean,
well, I think,
that leaves
Born, I think 300 was pretty amazing.
Compass.
Yeah, I think 300 would probably be on the list as at least something that was a little bit unique. I mean, it's not like it's never been done before, and you got to look back to Sin City
I found it to be much better integrated. I mean, I think that as a film that we're shooting all green screen and or largely green screen. I mean, mm-hmm. to be honest with you, it was more green screen. When I looked at the behind the scenes of 300, it was more green screen than even I had originally suspected.
Yeah,
you know, it was really amazing in how far they had gone with that, and I really, you know, I thought, I've watched it more times than I'd like to imagine. I'd like to admit, you know, it's just one of those things that you watch it, and there's little pieces of it that you really like to watch over and again, over and over again, or there's little sections, and I just felt like it really took filmmaking to a different level as far as that kind of really taking advantage of the fact that we're no longer in a, you know, in a set.
I agree, although, you know, at some level I think it's a triumph of art direction more so than visual effects necessarily, but I mean, I think
you're getting into that whole problem
of
about it's really hard to separate content from, you know, I mean, if you have a really appalling film with good visual effects, it's extraordinarily hard to get past the fact that the, you know, thing sucked.
Yeah, I mean, there were. If you look closely at 300, I don't, you know, technically there was so much work in it, but there were some dodgy comps in there in terms of, I mean, given how stylized it was, you could hide a lot of it. But if you look at the edge quality on a lot of the green screen pulls, you know, it's far from perfect in a lot of places. And you know, given the budget they worked with, that's not so. It was a fairly low budget movie given all the work they did.
The one that caught me by surprise was Evan Almighty. I had no idea how big the budget was on that. I don't have the number, but it's astronomical, the budget on that film. Did you guys actually see the film?
I didn't see it.
Yeah, it was a fun movie.
It was a fun movie.
It did not do well, did it?
Well, not for the amount of money they laid out.
Yeah, they spent $175 million, and the U.S. return, U.S. box office was $100 million.
Ouch.
Yeah. Ow. So not as yeah. bad though. Not as bad right now as the one that looks like the big the one that's having the most trouble, I think, at the moment is the
Golden Compass or
yeah Golden yeah. Compass is the one that looks like it's Golden Compass and Beowulf of all things.
Yeah. You know, talking about movies that I wouldn't mind seeing nominated, or at least in the seven, I would definitely put Golden Compass in there. I thought, you know, the animal work and a lot of it was actually quite good.
Oh, I want to see Harry Potter in there in Order of Phoenix. I think the England houses have done an outstanding job with the entire franchise, and it gets better. And, you know, maybe it's considered to be standard work in the sense that it's not vastly pushing the art in one way or another. But, I mean, I go to those films, and they quality of the visual effects work is outstanding.
I agree. But, you know, I think the problem it's going to have is what do you point to in that movie as being, oh, that was something new and really well done and surprising and special.
Well, which brings us to the question of, is that the criteria upon which the Oscar should be awarded?
Right.
Innovation versus, you know, technical accomplishment. In other words, are you looking for that in the other categories? In music, are you looking for innovation, or are you looking for, you know, in cinematography? I mean, I'm not saying that you shouldn't. I'm just saying, is that the, I think it probably is. I think the thing that probably, you know, helps a film get over the line is definitely that it seemed to be doing something new and it hasn't been done before.
I think that adds something to it. I mean, you have to vote on it sort of. I mean, I'm in the British Academy, and, you know, when I vote on these things, I do give some weight towards, did they do something new? Is there, because it is a technical achievement award at some level. It's both, right? It's art and science, and I think that doing something that hasn't been done before, from either a visual sense like 300 or from a technical sense like some of these movies, I think that's part of the weighting of it, at least.
Because, I mean, in terms of technical accomplishment, Bourne Ultimatum just didn't, for me, drop a... I mean, it was just great. It was just really technically on the ball.
Yeah. Yeah. These days, though, it's almost the anomaly that a movie is has obvious flaws, isn't it?
No. I always go back to this. Just my criteria is just give me one or two shots of characters driving in a car, and I'll tell you whether or not they've got it down.
Or on a train. Or yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Digital haircuts as the
yeah, exactly.
That shrinks around their forehead.
Yeah, yeah, everyone, digital gel. Yeah, I mean, now if you guys were going to pick one, what would you pick?
Yeah.
I got to put. Yeah, I got to put.
Do you want to win, or that you think will win? It's kind of two different things, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I like I said, I would like to see Compass get some recognition. I don't think it will, because I think the movie did so poorly, it's going to be, you know, considered to be a problematic movie. But again, I mean, what did you guys think about the work in Compass? It wasn't flawless. I think there were stuff that didn't work, but overall, I thought the level of, you know, integration with the animals, the amount of stuff in there was impressive.
I have to admit that I don't think I've seen a visual effects movie since my baby was born.
So, the most spectacular visual effects.
Yeah, there were some incredible visual effects. And let me tell you, the animatronics are just amazing. You know, you look at it and you just go, well, the arm isn't working yet, but it's getting there. It's a little spasming.
Better than that Children of Men shot?
The what?
Better than that shot in Children of Men last year?
Yeah, it's definitely better than that.
Okay. It's hard to judge visual effects when your eyes are watering.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the...
Looking forward, is there anything you guys are looking forward to in 2008? Because there's some interesting films coming up.
Indy's out in 2008, right?
Indy, as in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
Well, I did some research, so I'll try and give you the dates. At the moment, because it's all changed, it's May 22nd, 2008.
Uh-huh. Wow.
With the woman, or the actress from Transformers, as his sidekick.
Ooh.
Ah.
Hey, yes. Now the... with Indy, I bet you that date is pretty hard, because it's in the can, right? I mean, they've already shot it all.
I don't know, is it?
Yeah, it's shot, I think. The finished principal photography.
Well, I mean, the main thing is that, I don't mean in the can, I mean the principal photography is done. What I mean is that we're not worried about, you know, the big thing that's going to put a lot of pressure on next year is the scripts.
These features aren't ever going to be affected, are they, by the...
Right.
So. Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a couple of things. Star Trek 11, which is Abrams going to return to the new... that's meant to be the end of the year, so that's December 25th. So I guess anything that's scheduled for the end of the year could theoretically run into script revision-y type issues that could cause something to get pushed back.
Yeah, there's two problems. One is the scripts right now, and then the second problem coming up in the summer is going to be the possible actor-director issues. Although the director's probably not, but SAG is more of an issue. So it's so that'll be interesting to see.
Any interest in seeing Speed Racer? That'll age you.
I was a huge Speed Racer fan.
Me too.
Crazy big speed. I mean, I came home every day, and I had to come down my run. We had a half mile driveway, and I had to run almost the whole way down to make sure that at 3:30 I was at the TV to watch the Speed Racer. So it was, I love watching it. I have to admit, when I saw the trailer, I was like, either I'm really gonna love this or I'm really gonna hate it. And I
don't know yet. I'm doing some consulting work at Digital Domain, and they're doing some of the work on it. And I've only seen like little tiny snippets, and it's, you know, it's extremely stylized kind of stuff. And I'll see some things, and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And I'll see other things that I'm just like, I can't. It's, there's a lot of stuff going on in there. I'm not quite sure how it works in context. But I got to say, when I saw the trailer for it, and the theme music starts playing, I'm there.
Yeah.
As soon as I heard that theme music, it's like, I don't care. I'm going.
Yeah, yeah. It's that's a gimme as far as that
goes. I feel the same way about two other films. I'm definitely interested in seeing The Dark Knight because
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
That Double Negative just did such a magnificent job on the last time around. So that's going to be good.
Yeah.
But also, I've got to say, any time there's a major Pixar film like WALL-E, and I think that's just going to be a cracker.
What's the release date on that?
27th of June.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, I've seen the trailer for that in a cinema. So just the quality of the rendering of the backgrounds just melts me compared to what I see in, you know, I don't know, almost any other animated film these days. Like, you know, you go and see something like the Bee Movie, and it's just a TV show in a cinema, right? And
yeah.
then you go and see the trailer for WALL-E, which was on before it, in this case, in the cinema.
That's
I was
not fair.
It's just like, you guys, yeah, that is just crushing. And I mean, the nuances of the character animation for a fairly much an inert square box kind of character, and the longing look in this stupid square box's character's sort of, quote, face as it stares up at the stars. And I was just, oh, this is going to be just right up their alley. If there isn't like 1,000 kids screaming for WALL-E's, as, you know, the wind-up toys within about a second of seeing the film, I'd be surprised.
Pixar stuff is just a lesson in building a self-consistent environment, too. You know, it's something that I really notice a lot in animated movies where it feels like certain areas are given more attention than others, and it often feels a little pieced together. And I think Beowulf had that problem to an extent where some things look just perfect, and other stuff didn't have nearly the attention paid to it. And, you know, with all the Pixar stuff, I mean, it is a really self-contained, completely self-realized kind of a world that you go into.
It's a delight to watch because if you're got kids along, they're going to enjoy it. But, I mean, just technically, superb state-of-the-art kind of... But as you're saying, this kind of stylized way. They're not necessarily just trying to get to realism and then not quite make it. They're just saying, this is the world we want to have.
And I have to admit, I usually just plan on that I'm going to see any Pixar film twice. You know, that I'm going to always...
Oh.
I'm always... Well, and any of these films, I mean, a lot of...
I'm saying only twice?
Well, I mean, but I'm going to see it twice in the theater to make sure that... I mean, because I literally tell myself I'm going to see it twice because I'm going to go in and not think about the effects at all and just watch the film. And I put it in the back of my head like, okay, I'll think about this later. You know, like I'll when I watch it the second time, I'm just going to break it down. You know, and I'll look at all the lighting and everything else. And I do everything I can not to think about that during the actual thing. And same thing with, I mean, I do that with a lot of movies. I mean, I did that with Transformers and Pirates and everything else where I just want to enjoy it once and then start cutting it up because otherwise there's so much to learn. I mean, you know, in many of these, but I mean, especially in like a Pixar film, there's so much to learn about lighting and rendering and everything else when just by watching the result.
So as long as we're handicapping, we want to pick the three animated movie nominees. I mean, Ratatouille is clearly one of the three.
Well, then you have Shrek.
Shrek's potentially there. I think I haven't seen this yet. Have either of you seen the Persepolis, the traditional style animated movie set in Iran?
No, I haven't seen that.
I hear it's spectacular. It wouldn't surprise me.
I just really hope that I hope that Pixar gets recognized because it's almost, I got a feeling with some of the stuff that they almost, you know, sometimes you get a either a director or a film studio, like Pixar, that gets taken for granted. Like you expect them to do great work because it's Pixar and therefore you don't reward them, but it doesn't take away from the fact that I just think they just do the best work going and consistently year in, year out. So I certainly hope they get it. If it's a deserving award, and I don't know about technical or innovation award. I don't know about the animation it was great. I just hadn't really thought about it from a character animation point of view. I guess it was fairly traditional in terms of if you were judging it solely on animation style.
For Ratatouille?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just
perfect.
Words,
what's your criteria for judging animated feature?
Yeah, that's...
I don't know. It's true because at some level you really want to just say, all right, it's the best movie. which is why I mentioned Persepolis, just because I've seen so many, you know, great reviews on it that I think it's I would actually be willing to bet that's one of the three nominees. So in my mind, it's going to be Persepolis, Ratatouille, and then the third one is kind of the big open question, whether it's Shrek or Simpsons movie, maybe. I don't know.
That'd be a turn up for the books, wouldn't it? That'd be very interesting.
Yeah.
I actually don't think Shrek 3 was a great film.
No.
I thought there was some great stuff in it, but I just didn't think it was a great film.
The story started to tap out a little bit. You know, I think they've gone to the well, possibly.
Once Eric Idle left the screen, it was... Give me a Python any day.
So the what are you guys handicapping as far as the visual effects films?
I don't know. I mean, you know, if I had to guess, like I said, it would be the three sequels. But I don't know.
What do you think technically was the best? I mean,
Pirates.
Pirates.
Just technically, in terms of scale, all the aspects that they were doing,
yeah,
it was just remarkable.
Yeah,
I mean, and also ILM just presents well at the Bake Off.
Yeah.
Now, Ron, how about you?
Yeah, I would probably guess Pirates as well. I mean, Spider-Man's the work they did with the sand stuff was interesting. I mean, the scene where the Sandman is sort of being born, being formed, I thought was extremely nice overall. Yeah, a lot of it was sort of the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't talked about I Am Legend. I suspect it'll be in the 7, maybe. I don't know. What do people think?
I thought it should be in the 7.
Yeah.
You're right, we haven't mentioned it. I thought it was... I'd much prefer to see I Am Legend there than I personally would want to see National Treasure or, you know, a couple of the others.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of criticism for the night creatures in terms of the way they moved, which you almost have to blame on probably the director and instead of the effects crew, because at least everything I've seen is that, you know, he asked for this sort of hyper reality in terms of how fast they moved and everything, and it's that's where it crossed that line to being a little bit not believable. I mean, I love the opening stuff with the whole New York City abandoned kind of thing. But I eat that kind of stuff up anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and also I think for a general sort of breathtaking thing, just, you know, presenting so many of those exteriors without people, it was just, you know, it was something that you could relate to, I guess.
Yeah, it was nice. It set the scene quite well. Well, that movie ultimately kind of pissed me off because I thought they kind of popped out at the end. I mean, you know, as I was watching it in the middle of it, I was like, you know, I was really thinking, you know, this was a great science fiction movie. And then, I don't know, in the last, for me, it all kind of fell apart in the last 5 minutes, but oh well.
I have to admit, I quite liked The Omega Man.
Yeah, great movie. Classic.
I thought it was good. If I remember correctly, his girlfriend there had a really cool afro. I thought she was a really cool chick.
That's right. You can find the trailer for that online in a bunch of places, and it's just hilarious. Go check it out.
I don't want to. I remember it as being great and really, really, really frightening.
So it sounds like we're all pretty much. I mean, to me, I think that, you know, for technical, I mean, I think Pirates with a close with Transformers coming in second. And then after that, it's, you know, Spider-Man 3 or Harry Potter or, you know, as far as the, you know.
Yeah, Transformers could win it. I could easily see Transformers win it as well.
Well, I guess one thing, it isn't, while it's, you know, obviously based on the toys and stuff, it isn't actually like we saw those effects in the previous Transformers film, because it wasn't one, if that makes sense. Like, whereas Pirates, I think they did really amazing original stuff and really pushed the boundary. Still, you could argue it's a building on the motion capture work that they did in 2.
And you know, Spider-Man 3, I think. Yeah, and the Academy has and both of those have won Oscars, right? So, and the Academy may just say that, you know, that work has... I mean, when you make two movies back to back, you know, it is almost, you know, it's you've really done a set of work, and they may almost consider it as, all right, well, we already awarded that, you know, so time to award for something different, which is probably a good argument for why Transformers may even have a better shot at it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that Transformers was, you know, really, really good technically. It just didn't set my afterburners alight the way some of the other films did when I was actually watching them. But, you know, I always had a bit of a problem with the kind of Transformer thing. It just, you can't. Some films, I just can't get into them that much. I mean, I look at them and they're great, and I'm like, you know what? It's a large talking toy.
The part of Transformers that I like to watch is I have a bad habit of watching just sections of films over and over and over again, and because there's something I like about them, and I'll just sit there and break it up until I figure out what it is that has me drawn to it. And it's when you see the four of them coming through space. You know, mm-hmm. So it's you know, like they go and they park, you know, in front of whatever, some monument, and the four of these you see the space shot, and there's something about the music and the four of them coming across. You know, it's kind of that classic, almost Armageddon. You could tell. I mean, it was almost taken from Armageddon. They probably used it in the animatic of a kind of a whip pan of the guys going by the camera.
Yep.
And there's something about it. It's such the classic. You know, the good guys coming to save the world kind of thing, with the right music and everything else. The only thing that screwed it up is they had her grab onto his hand, like in the middle of it. There was like this one intercut of her grabbing on. And by the way, I have tried editing that out, and it actually works much better. Take that little bit out, you know. But I kind of want to do the phantom edit of that one. And so but it's just such a great, you know, build up. It's very classic Michael Bay too. You know, it's just we're not trying to be subtle or confusing or whatever. We're telling you that this is here it comes. You know, and it's a good straight up. You know, I think Transformers is a good straight up film that way. And I think that the effects are. You know, pretty amazing. I mean, I at first I was kind of like, well, it's mechanical, but man, those are some complex mechanicals.
I guess the other thing is that we've been discussing films that are in this 15, right? But there are some films outside the 15 that I think really were great last year. And I think the Bond film in particular, Bourne Ultimatum, we already discussed, and maybe Bond was a reaction to that. But that was, you know, that was really well done. It was a good film. I mean,
was
we couldn't
just leave.
Wasn't it?
It almost seemed, I don't know. It almost feels like that was a year before last. Maybe not.
I think it was last year.
I thought it was the beginning. I thought it was the beginning of last year, but hey.
Okay. No, I don't know. It could be. No, I agree, though. The work was very well done on that. What about
any other films?
Yeah. What about that Danny Boyle movie, Sunshine?
Well, Sunshine's in the list of ones for contention for the Bake Off. And I thought the Sun stuff in that was just magnificent.
Yeah, it was nice. It was, again, you know, looking at it from sort of an art direction point of view, there was some really nice stuff in there, I thought.
I just kept on having Lost in Space flashbacks.
Huh?
I just kept on having Lost in Space flashbacks.
So
I was surprised at the amount of work in it, I guess just because I sort of associate him with lower budget. And it was a big budget movie, So whenever I saw it, I was pleasantly surprised to see how much work was in it, and good work, too. I think that was mostly done over in the UK as well, I believe, right?
Yeah, and no, they did a great job. And it was funny, because it was released in the UK and Australia ages before it was released in the US. I don't know why that is.
I enjoyed it. It was a decent little flick.
So I think that we've run up to the end of this. I think we have an idea of what we looked at in the past. Anything you want to add to the either 2007 or 2008?
I was kind of surprised that there was no mention of Silver Surfers and some of those other films. And I don't know. I guess for me, there are other films like Zodiac that I thought were really impressive and did some really interesting things, but are obviously not going to make it into the cut of getting the Oscar.
Right.
But I don't think it was a bad year. I think it was a good year.
I think it's one of the biggest visual effects years ever when you look at the sheer amount of money going into it.
Yeah, I think, you know, there was a lot of work and it was all good work. But on the other hand, I don't think there was anything this year that you would point to like you have in past years and just blew me away. You know, I mean, I remember, you know, a couple of years ago when the first Pirates came out. I mean, that was, you know, looking at it saying, wow, you know, that's something that's beyond what I've seen. And, you know, going back most years, you can point to something, you know, on The Matrix or on Jurassic Park or T2 or whatever, where they were, you know, there were years where it's clearly, you know, wow, that's something I haven't seen before.
Well, are we getting to a plateau?
We've still got Get Smart to come out this coming 2008. I'm sorry, Barbara Feldon. Oh my God!
Are we reaching a plateau where almost anything's just we expect it all to be clean and perfect?
Kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, having said that, I mean, you can make that statement about anything, right? And a really good artist is going to push the envelope and come up with stuff that you haven't seen before. I mean, you know, take The Matrix as an example. That was not just we've done something that has been done in movies before, but done it much better. You know, that was completely new kind of a concept. And I would hope that we will continue to get those little surprises, but they may be a little bit fewer and far between, I suppose.
Yeah.
No, I think we'll get them. I think it's just, you know, if we could imagine what this thing is that's going to blow us away, it won't blow us away because by definition it's going to come from left field and we aren't going to expect it. I mean, it's being made right now somewhere or somebody's put it on a storyboard somewhere. It's just, you know, by very definition we're going to go, oh my God, I wish I'd thought of that.
I think we're also finding that, you know, visual effects has just become so ubiquitous with all these films that you just, you know, it used to be a big deal to do, you know, we've talked about this before. We're old and crotchety here, you know, so we're talking about, I remember when it was a big deal to do 200, you know, 200 shots, you know, and now, you know, 200 shots is like a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Absolutely. It's just, you know, that we're going to fix up. And so it just really has, you know, crossed all these boundaries that used to be there. And I do think it's interesting. You know, it didn't really sink in for me how much the effects industry has. I mean, it's always been big grocers have had lots of effects. But when you look at how, you know, that all the whole top 10 is all, you know, in that field, I think it's very fascinating that it'll be interesting to see if that happens again next year.
I think the one area where you will clearly see, you know, a lot of innovation coming out that I don't really think we have that much yet is in stylized kind of looks for movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the 300 is an example of, you know, I think it's going to be looked back as one of the initial films that pushed it in a particular direction. But I really think there's far more that can be done with that and, you know, a whole range of different kind of looks that can be brought to a movie. And yeah, it certainly straddles a line between art direction. I mean, it crosses the line over into art direction, but it is also, you know, requires the visual effects tool set to do it.
And, we haven't seen the definitive human CG character that we've all gone, oh my God, I couldn't tell that was CG. And like, what happens when the Beowulf team makes the film two or three from now where that happens and then all gloves are off, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which to me is less interesting, though, than the, you know, what happens if you put that much effort into trying to achieve a specific look that the director or the art director has or some, you know, reference material has. You know, put as much work as you put towards trying to make it photoreal into taking it in some other direction instead. And for me, I think that's really where it's going to get interesting.
I think also a challenge is going to be making them more affordable. I think that's going to happen.
Hang on a sec. But if you get a completely CG character that you can't pick, right, then suddenly you can make a Beatles film, right, where it's John Lennon and you're just got real actors all around him and there's a completely CG John Lennon there who's delivering the lines. He just looks like John Lennon, and we all remember looks like John Lennon. He just isn't an actor, right? And we haven't hit that yet. We're still a few years off it. But when that happens,
how many years?
It'll open up a lot of, well, I don't know, but it's going to open up a lot of dramatic possibilities.
Well, guess,
I mean, you know,
guess. How many years? What do you? How many years are you going to call it?
Four years.
4 years.
Two more iterations, so that would be
run.
You know, two.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable estimate.
Four.
I mean, there were shots inside of Beowulf where they would pass, but it wasn't sustainable. You know, it obviously wasn't sustainable. And I don't know if that was just because they, you know, at some point, just with a given budget, you have to say, all right, we can't concentrate on this shot as much, or if it truly was, you know, those shots, you got lucky because they didn't happen to be mouthing particular. I mean, it's all in the, you know, the dialogue stuff where it really starts to fall apart still.
I mean, that innovation of putting the probes on the actors' faces to pick up the muscles that were moving mm-hmm. the eyeballs so you knew yep. where the eyes were looking, but not tracking the eyeballs, but actually mathematically working out where the muscle moved the eyes to look was a pretty substantial innovation.
Yeah. And, you know,
once you push that a few more generations.
Yeah, I still think, I mean, as far as having a lead character, or even a support character that is totally photoreal, I'm still thinking a decade or more. You know, it's
10 years
or more. I'd say I would safely say 15 to 20 years. But the reason is just that I think that our and of course we're going to see digital stunt doubles, you know, taking over large portions of that problem. But I think that when we talk about real leads and so on and so forth, really becoming, I mean, I think Beowulf was an amazing push forward, but I, you know, don't think it was that close. You know,
but here's my thing. If you did Forrest Gump 2, effectively, yeah? Not actually Forrest Gump 2, but, you know, a Forrest Gump type film, mm-hmm. where the characters he was interacting with right. were, you know, you only there for a couple of scenes.
Yeah, you wanted to have something more than just lip morphing of existing footage. You just decided, I'm going to redo Kennedy as a full virtual character. I bet you could get really close, but... Yeah,
so I reckon two generations on from now, maybe it's 6 years, not four, but two generations on from now, and you could do that, and you could have a Tom Hanks interacting with a Kennedy where you wouldn't be able to pick it wasn't Kennedy, and yet he clearly wasn't because he was directly dealing with our hero or whatever. Now, I think your point about having a film built on a character, maybe that's true, maybe it is a decade out, but having certainly that kind of a
having some element people there, I mean, maybe 6 years, but I think it's 6 to 10 is my guess, because I just think that it's doing that last little 1% is 1,000 times harder than 99. You know, and that's the problem, is that and we're so good at looking at it. If they're at a distance, it's fine. Like the Forrest Gump stuff, maybe you could get away with it. You can get away with a little bit of the film breakup. You can get away with lots of things that can kind of sink that in. But, you know, when I see stuff like that looks very realistic. I don't see stuff and go, that's real. You know, I haven't seen very many humans that I get that feeling for.
At some level, I think the thing that's probably going to push it out is, you know, it's going to take a director to come along and say, I need this because of this. And,
right.
you know, if a script shows up and the director that's got enough clout behind him decides to make it, and that is 4 years away, then I believe it probably could happen. But that, you know, I thought, you know, what exactly is that movie that's going to require it? And that may not be for many more years beyond that. You know, there may be no good reason to really do it. And I don't think any studio is going to pony up the money just because they want to be the first one to have done it.
Other than, you know, I couldn't figure out, I have to admit that I didn't do all the math with, and I was like, how does Zemeckis get these kind of budgets to, you know, to go play, you know? And then I saw something in one of the trades, I don't know what it was, but it was listing the top grossing directors, and of course Zemeckis is number two over all his films, you know, and so...
Even Polar Express, which, you know, when it first came out, was looked at as, oh my God, you know, this is a huge bomb. It ended up actually making significant money for the studios, and in no small part because of, you know, it's a holiday perennial kind of thing, and they made their money back, you know, if not in the first year, then certainly in the second year with all the re-releases and everything.
I'm not saying this from any point of having any inside knowledge, but I remember somebody talking to about Woody Allen once, saying, how does Woody Allen keep making these films when he doesn't make a whole lot of money? And someone said, well, look at it from the studio's point of view, right? He delivers on time, on budget, he's not an asshole to deal with, he doesn't blow out, we know what to expect, and we can pretty much plan out how it's going to work, and there's an audience that's sort of built in. And as long as he doesn't try and make, you know, Ben-Hur again and completely blow the model. And I saw, to a certain extent, I'm sure that's what happened with Zemeckis, right? He's probably a nice guy who can plan to make very reliably deliver-the-goods type films that are going to be big and make money in DVD and all that kind of stuff. And it's just sort of factored in that it's, you know, you're in there for the long haul with him, and one or two will be killer and one or two will be slightly less. But it's, you know, it's as opposed to breaking ground with new directors who are going to go off and it's going to be a nightmare and it's going to be a problem. I'm sure he's just got a well-oiled team, and it just, you know what I mean? Like it's a sensible way to make films, mm-hmm. and he delivers and reliably so.
Yeah. No, I agree. We better tie this one up, or people are going to be getting to the end of their drive and wondering why we're still talking about visual effects. Ron, where can people find out more about your stuff?
I don't know. digitalcompositing.com, but I haven't updated it in 8 months. So.
But you're going to have your new book up there, right?
Yeah, so once the book is actually starting to roll again, I'll start dealing more with a web presence, and, you know, and you'll definitely hear from me again, and I'll be pitching it like a madman. But
Excellent. And then Mike, of course, is at FX Guide. So and
yeah,
FX
and we
PhD.
Just started a new term at FX PhD. So this term we're is about to start next week, is focused on motion graphics. So we're doing a lot of stuff on typography, design, motion graphics stuff, in addition to the other stuff we've been doing on production and post. But yeah, it's certainly nice to have the addition of some really cool motion graphic stuff. So
sounds great.
Yeah, no, it's really good. It's a joy to be able to move into new areas, and certainly we've been pestered for this one longer than I can possibly remember. And do you know Tim Clapman from? He's coming into the After Effects stuff, and we got a whole bunch of really good guys doing stuff there. So that's great. And we had such a great term last term with when we added the production stuff and started doing things like the Red Camera and DV Rebel and that kind of stuff. So
right.
This whole idea of tackling new new areas is working for us, so we're having fun doing that. It's really really good. And I'm off to Sundance for whatever that is, the 22nd. So I guess I'll talk to you before that.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Right.
You have two, right? Is that right?
There's one that we did the effects on for director Nash Edgerton, and it's called Spider, which is a great film and has already gone well. It won, I think, Best Short at the AFIs in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong on the exact category, but went very well at the AFIs in LA, and that got into Sundance. And then one that we produced at FX PhD called I Love Sarah Jane, which is our zombie love story, or love in a post-zombie world, and that's it's pretty chunky. And that's also got in, and so that's great. So we're going to go over to Sundance, and we're also going to do FX Guide TV live from Sundance, which will be good.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, in fact, I'm just going to miss you because you've got a lot of stuff on at Macworld, which I'm really bummed I can't get to.
It's
going to
be insane. I have to admit, I'm the reality of it has sunk in. We're we're running the running the podcast studio at Macworld. So in addition to having a team do probably somewhere between 10 and 30 episodes of MacBreak that week, we're actually on the floor doing probably some of the top. I mean, really, really heavy duty like podcasting training. Some of the most intense training that we've done ever for an audience. So we have like a little theater that IDC gave us that'll hold like 200 or 300 people, and we're just gonna be giving up doing seminars and doing podcasts and talking about how we do them, and it's gonna be a very fascinating experiment, to have it there. It's going to be basically what we did with GMT, the Gear Media Tech, basically on the floor. So instead of making people pay for it, it costs you whatever it costs to get into the expo, and so
you've got so many good people, like Scott Bourne for a start. He's a great guy.
Yeah, and
so,
Scott's
a lot of great people.
And there's just a lot of. It's going to be very. Scott's Pod Dango and Scott are also doing one in the conference, and so Macworld is really going to be probably one of the best places to learn about podcasting. Ever in the history of podcasting, all 2 or 3 years of it, this one Macworld is going to be really, really fun. So,
with the writer's strike, it must be particularly relevant, I guess.
Well, it's super exciting. I mean, the thing is that people are really starting to sink in as the strike drags on that. People who are not making content for the general industry are going to have a huge boom. If it continues to drag out, so there's just a lot of people who are doing online media, Netflix, cable networks. There's all kinds of beneficiaries. There's a lot,
and I think a lot of the writers are really exploring. They've realized that it's their time to figure out some alternate avenues too. So I think you're going to see writers showing up at some of these things.
Well, and I think that they need to. I mean, I think that one of the things. This is getting us a little outside of visual effects, but one of the things that I think is important is that is to realize. I mean, the studios really could have the strike last for a very, very long time, years. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't because they're big. They're part of big corporations that they represent. A very small percentage of the bottom line. So this really could drag out for a long time. And writers need to find other ways. Even if they get a deal, it's not going to be a very good one. And because it never is. And the thing that they really have to figure out is why are we, and this is a problem for all of us that create media, why are we trying to go through these pipes when we could really build our own? And I think that there are a lot of artists that are kind of thinking kind of the front edge of that right now, both writers and actors and everything else thinking that, we don't really need the system, to do this. And you're looking at, I guess, the rumor of Jay-Z, building a record company with Apple,
mm-hmm. a label.
Yeah. And that is the, if that doesn't scare the RIAA, it should.
Now, so just give it the details of, so you're at Macworld, I know, but just for people that don't, there's sort of the stream that you have to pay to get into, but there's all you're talking about people can actually get to by going to Macworld, right?
The only thing that people need to pay for to go to Macworld is the expo pass, which is like $25. And so, and we're going to put up probably either on twit.tv or on my own little blog, which should come out next week. There'll be a schedule, actually a schedule that you can load into your iPhone or whatever, into iCal, as well as a link that either you'll get a free, depending on, we have a certain number of free tickets that we were going to give away, or you'll get it for $10 or something. I think it's like $10 or $15. And so for $10 to $15, you'll get, it's a pass to look at the entire expo, see all the cool stuff and whatever Apple's releasing and, you know, all that stuff. And lots of iPhone accessories. You know, usually at Macworld, that's something if you need that kind of thing. But you'll also get access to 4 days of us putting up tons and tons and tons of both podcasts as well as how we do podcasts. And it's going to be, I'm actually doing a big chunk of the mornings. And then we have podcasts in the afternoon. We have Leo Laporte talking about the business end of things and how to work on podcasts. And we have, you know, tons of other technical guys, Craig Severson coming in. And if anyone's ever seen, you know, Craig Severson is a great way to distill. He takes all this complex stuff and distills it down into something that is easy to understand. So we're going to be doing that. But yeah, it's the cost will be somewhere between $10 and $25 for 4 days of heavy duty training. So it's pretty, it's as good a deal as you're going to get. You know, and then if you decide to pony up the $600 or $400 or whatever the price is for the conference, there's more training that's available. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, and you'll be wearing a black turtleneck, I presume?
No, actually, my uniform tends to be I have when I do any kind of public appearance now, I have black Tommy Bahama shirts. I have like three or four of them, and they all look relatively the same because I got into this whole thing about TV where I just got tired of worrying about, like, when you go to tech TV and I'm on, I'll be doing four shows in a single day. And I got tired of changing my shirt. So I was like, you know what? I just wear a black shirt. And so these Tommy Bahama ones are really nice silk shirts. And so that's all. You'd see me in jeans and a Tommy Bahama shirt is pretty much my standard. So anyway, and if you don't know what those are, you'll see them for the episodes. And by the way, the episodes are going to be great. It's not just Leo and I are going to be wandering around, but we're also going to have Kirsten Sanford from Food Science and This Week in Science talking about switching to the Mac, which she just did, and looking for accessories for that. You'll also have Callie Lewis from Geek Brief, Justine Ezerich, who's iJustine, Kendra
Aramoto. Merlin? Is Merlin there?
Sorry?
Is Merlin back?
No, I don't. Merlin is he's on child duty, and his child duty is evidently much more intense than my child duty. So I thought mine was pretty intense, you know. But so he's been hard to schedule. So we may see an episode with Merlin if we can twist his arm. But it's hard to get him to schedule anything right now. He's kind of he does a lot of work, but it's all on his own schedule. So hard to say. So we're not sure.
Well. I know I have to fly, and I know you were trying to wrap it up, and I opened up a can of worms, but I think it is interesting, and certainly I'm regretting I might be able to be there, but I'll be en route to a very cold place to watch short films at midnight. So, but hopefully we'll speak before then anyway.
Yeah, definitely, and we'll be shooting, by the way, for the behind-the-scenes stuff. We're going to be shooting with the new Sony EX, which we just arrived. And we're pretty excited about. So we'll, in Gear Media Tech, our show about that, we'll be showing you how we're putting this stuff together. But it's a total tapeless process. It's like it's not as good as the Red, but it's it's small and easy and shoots pretty good images. So until later. Thanks, guys, for checking in.
Yeah, great to catch up with you guys again.
And I think that with this larger group of people, I think we'll be fairly regular about this. So until later, keep it real.